You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of May 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
we are not here to lecture. We are not here to tell other people how to live, what to do, who to be, or how to worship. Instead, we are here to offer partnership based on shared interests and values.
U.S. President Donald Trump on tour in the Middle East, but will his apparent, if obviously scripted, humility impress either his hosts or the folks back home? My guests Robert Fox and Jeffrey Howard will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including the continuation of North Korea's missile test program, merely tedious or actually reckless. A walkout of college graduates as U.S. Vice President Mike Pence laments the ebbing of free speech on campus. Were the walkouters kind of proving his point? And why is China exporting Karl Marx to his birthplace? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Robert Fox, defence editor at The Evening Standard, and Jeffrey Howard, lecturer in political theory at University College London. Welcome both. And we will start tonight with the first overseas foray as US president by Donald Trump, which began in Saudi Arabia over the weekend and is continuing in Israel today. As we go to air and confounding the expectations of certain sceptical observers, Trump has not perpetrated any irrecoverable clangers, unless one counts as such concluding a $110 billion arms deal with one of the most repressive regimes on earth, and which Trump himself had accused of orchestrating the terror attacks against the United States on September 11th, 2001. In fairness, though the quest for Trump's strong suit is ongoing, it has been more or less determined by now that consistency isn't it. Jeffrey, how is he doing generally in the Middle East, do we think?
He's doing pretty well on this trip. He hasn't made any substantial gaffes yet. And I think that's because this is exactly what the president does well. He loves wining and dining. He loves wheeling and dealing. He loves chatting to people and trading off of the banalities of personal interactions and formal conversations. So I think that the reason that he's doing okay is that there haven't really been any substantive policy discussions so far. He read out his speech about how Islam needs to change, but even that was surprisingly uncontroversial. So it's only a matter of time, I think, before he does make a gaffe, but so far he hasn't made any major snafus.
This is the excellent joke somebody made a while back, and I forget who it was, annoyingly, that what Trump always wanted was not to be president, but to be called president. Robert, do you get the sense that he's enjoying the pomp and ceremony? And I guess more pertinently, the headline story from Saudi Arabia, the $110 billion arms deal, is that any more or less really than the depressing real politic with which we have been treating the Saudis now for decades?
Well, there are several in that. The deal is playing catch up with the Brits and the French, and they want to do it. I think Trump is quite keen on arms deals. The extravagance with which he's looking at his own defense and military programs, I doubt really that they've got the industrial base to do all that he has said that he is going to do, things like 350 ship navy and so on. So park that. Funny enough, I slightly disagree. I don't think he's enjoying this too much because he'd find it very tiring, we're hearing, and it is very complicated. No, he doesn't like complexity. You can't reduce this to 140 characters. And while I agree entirely there have been no major slip-ups, there have been some risible moments with Tillerson denouncing the abuse of human rights and the common norms of democracy and civil society in Iran, standing next to the Saudi interior minister. So, you know, that was not lost at all on the Arab street, particularly the Arab street in among the Palestinians, where he is now. And there, again, he has oversold. He has said, you know, I'm the big deal maker. This is the big deal. I'm not entirely convinced that Donald Trump, this sounds very condescending, but condescend away I will. I don't think he really understands the difference between Gaza and Ramallah, for example, and the skullduggery and the messing around that's going on there. And I think, you know, having been there recently, that I am getting increasingly worried in the way that there is a consensus of a quite broad bloc, including the Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel, ganging up with Ramallah, Fatah-led Palestinians to diss and trash Hamas at all costs, to make them seem so toxic that they can't be negotiated with at all, forgive the grammar. But this is what's going on. And it's this kind of thing that if it isn't Trump, it's people around him, including Kushner, including H.R. McMaster, who seems to have devised this thing, have really got to get to grips with. And not to draw breath, the problem is that the clock is ticking. There is a real problem with Gaza now. There is a real problem brewing up on the northern border with Hezbollah, which, in worst case, is within months could start an all-out war with Lebanon all over again.
Jeffrey, to return to the speech he gave, which, as you correctly said, he read out and didn't really go off script terribly often, or indeed at all, really, that I noticed. It struck me that there was an attempt at a Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall moment with the motif drive them out, referring to terrorists, although obviously we won't be relying on any Saudi women to do that. But is that the kind of clarion call that is going to resonate around the Middle East? Does the Middle East want to listen to a lecture in expunging terrorism by Donald Trump, of all people? He was punctilious in noting that the overwhelming majority of victims of Islamist terror are Muslims and are in the Middle East. But is anyone likely to listen to him? And I guess the part B of that question is, did the kind of actually fairly amenable tone of the speech risk upsetting his crankier fans back home?
Donald Trump had a very precarious task in this speech because he was extraordinarily Islamophobic during the election. And so I think one of the tasks of the speech was to walk back some of the Islamophobia.
There wasn't Islamophobia a lot of talk about banning the entire faith from the United States.
There was no talk of banning the entire faith from the United States. There was no talk of any kind of fundamental incompatibility between Islam and constitutional liberal democracy. So I think the one reason that the speech wasn't particularly controversial is that he was trying to placate the Muslim world a bit in this speech by saying some pretty banal things. I mean, there was something quite striking about him talking about the evils of extremist Islam in a country that's the greatest exporter of radical Wahhabism in the entire world. And of course, Saudi Arabia does some things to combat terrorism, but doesn't do nearly enough to combat the strain of radical extremist Wahhabi Islam that is so important there, that is so pervasive there and has done so much damage around the world. I frankly think that Donald Trump hasn't really thought about this question in very much detail before. And by all accounts, Stephen Miller, the speechwriter that wrote the speech, wrote it shortly before the trip, and I wouldn't be surprised if Donald Trump hadn't rehearsed it many times before he gave it.
Robert, just a final thought on this before we press on to other things, because we do talk about President Trump an awful lot, which I suspect, to be honest, is at least partly the idea. What do we expect from the European leg of his trip, which is coming up? He will, of course, be meeting with NATO in Brussels, with the G7 in Taormina, and there are reports suggesting today that he's going to return to his familiar theme of threatening to pull the plug on America's involvement in NATO if everybody doesn't start coughing up 2% of their GDP.
Well, that won't work, and I've seen that report, and I think it's pretty thin because there is a lot going on. He is trying to discover a new best friend in Monsieur Macron, whom he is going to meet one-on-one, which is going to be very interesting. And it's very interesting that he's chosen to do that before Macron is really launched in his presidency, because we've got the big stumbling block, possibly for him, of the legislative elections coming up next month for he, Macron. And he really should be dealing with Merkel. But he can chunter on about NATO, but there are things going on there. Because one thing that Macron, with his new defense minister, Madame Guillard, is going for is saying, yeah, we're going to have a defense union. Yeah, we're going to have a common fund. It's not going to be that huge. We're going to have a new headquarters. Only 8 people appointed to it so far. But really, we're getting on and doing the European thing in defense. Mind you, I think that the European thing in defense, the EU component, which has always been there from the beginning but never fully realized, is going to be more wishful thinking, paper tigers, you name it, whatever metaphor you like. But something is going on there. And when it comes to Russia, and the eastern flank of the EU and NATO are very serious about Russia in a way still that I don't think that Mr. Trump appreciates. Former General Mattis certainly does, and certainly H.R. McMaster do. And I think from their body language, knowing them both a bit, is that they are posturing as if we're going to see this thing through, whether the Donald is in the White House or not. So there are things going. And I do think it's quite worrying. It's, you know, you can't do the Rumsfeld thing of the old, and Cheney of the old Europe and so on. This is a building block. He's got to make it work. And you can't be like the big bad wolf with NATO and blow it away as if it's the House of Cards. It's the only darned alliance which is effective. Okay, there are all kinds of Johnny-come-latelys, which you can use, and America can lead to do anything from piracy to counterterrorism and so on. And I think I fear that he's not going to be in listening mode, and there are people to listen to in Europe right now. Just to draw it to a conclusion, I think it's far more serious at this stage of his presidency than the Middle East component in this. He's got to start getting this right. If he gets it wrong, if he annoys Mahoya, that's serious. Brussels, that's serious. But if he really gets it wrong with Merkel and Germany, the undoubted leader of EU and now of NATO Europe, I think that he's going to be quite damaged.
Well, let's move along to a subject which may well end up relating to that, which is North Korea, a country which is persisting with its impression of the annoying little bloke who persistently pushes everyone's drinks over in the apparent hope that eventually somebody will validate his persecution complex by taking a swing at him. Yesterday, the paranoid hermit kingdom tested yet another missile, apparently of the Pukguksong 2 medium-range ballistic variety. It followed and may indeed have been a response to yet another demand by the UN Security Council that Pyongyang give all such endeavours an indefinite rest. Jeffrey, it is the 10th known missile test this year so far by North Korea. Now, if we assume that they are not trying to get bombed back into a pre-industrial state, what are they actually doing?
I think that this serves the North Korean regime incredibly well in terms of its domestic internal politics, such as they are. It serves the regime well in its attempt to build up a narrative that North Korea is under threat from the rest of the world. I mean, there's a reason very few people talk about the prospect of internal rebellion in North Korea, which is that there's a very strong narrative that binds people together. It is impossible to run a totalitarian society simply through the use of coercive law. Your people have to buy into the project of the regime. And I think one reason that the people of North Korea, at least a lot of them, brainwashed though they may surely be, buy into the project of the regime is because of this narrative of we are under threat from outsiders and therefore we have to build up an arsenal. So I think plausibly the dictator of North Korea is willing to go as far as he can while until he believes that there will be some kind of blowback. And he doesn't think he's crossed that line yet.
Just to follow that up briefly, though, you're quite right in that no dictatorship, however repressive, can exist without some measure of consent from the tyrannized. But if you're talking about it in terms of domestic these launches being for a domestic audience, if you are the North Korean regime, why not just tell your people you've launched a missile? How are they going to know any different?
This is an excellent question. And I think that this exposes the perhaps obvious fact that he isn't entirely rational, right? So clearly, if you had a handbook about how to be the most effective totalitarian tyrant possible, this guy would be falling somewhat short of the strictures of that handbook. What I do think is true, though, is that he is not a madman. He does not want to blow his country back into oblivion. There's no evidence of that. And so the new leader of South Korea says he's open to talks. Perhaps this is a slightly cold reception to the inauguration of the new president, but we'll see.
Robert, what inducements and or threats at this stage might actually persuade North Korea to knock it off?
Well, it's very difficult to work that out because we go back to Clinton and he got the Yongbyon facility stopped.
Indeed.
Allegedly. It was paused, as is now generally accepted, and offered assistance with the development of civil energy and so on. And I agree, that just doesn't seem to be available now. It's I think things are much more difficult with China than has appeared. I don't think things are good between America and China, contrary to what we've been led to believe. There is the latest New York Times revelations about CIA agents being wound up and being killed. So part of the difficulty of the serious end of the national security apparatus in the US, it's very, very difficult to read China in all this. I absolutely follow. What is he up to? The reason why he launches missiles and likes to have them photographed or shown on CNN is he likes Hollywood, like his father. They all love Hollywood. They love the show. But I think there's something, as we've just heard, which is more dangerous, which has been appearing over the past few weeks. North Korea appears, the hierarchy, to be more divided than we had been led to hitherto. It's partly an explanation of what was going on with the killing of, first of all, the uncle and then the half-brother and so on. And it does seem, as you do get in these hyper-inflated militaries, huge military, that you get clan loyalties. It is far from clear who is running what. Therefore, we come back to the Hollywoodization, that the young leader has to show that he is in charge. I wonder, too, if he is making mischief because of the controversy of the deployment of the U.S. TARD anti-missile system in the South, which is causing trouble with the more Pacific new head of government there. And I think that there are a lot of moving parts there. And when things move like this, they either vibrate, as they say in physics, sympathetically or unsympathetically, and that's why it's quite dangerous. What is worrying about these missiles is that they really do appear to be working. The regime has said that it can start mass industrial production soon, and hitherto there had been a certain amount of reliance on hacking, of mischief-making, of getting into the software in which the Israelis were alleged to have had a part. Well, always with such an initiative like Stuxnet, like all these other things in cyber warfare, generally it seems they can only work up to a point, unless you're it completely in the worlds of fiction with Elizabeth Salander and the girl with the dragon tattoo.
Well, Jeffrey, on that subject of how these things only work up to a point, the question with North Korea is how far from that point we actually are. North Korea now claiming that its missiles can strike Hawaii and Alaska, so that's as near to the US mainland, as it were, as makes no odds. Do we understand how close we are to the point at which doing something would be worse than doing nothing? Or the other way around, possibly.
It seems pretty clear that our intelligence on the ground in North Korea is pitiful. We know very, very little about what's actually going on there. I mean, the best experts think that it might be as far away as 2030, the time when Seattle, say, is within striking distance. I'm more worried about U.S. domestic politics in the face of all this. Donald Trump's headlines in the news have not been favorable. I don't know if you've noticed in the past couple of weeks. And when he returns back from this foreign trip, there's going to be an extraordinary amount of domestic political incentive to keep big dramatic issues like North Korea on the headlines, and questions about the special counsel Robert Mueller and his what will soon be a quite up and running investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election off the headlines. And so I think there's a danger here of Trump being tempted into spouting his mouth off and saying some things about North Korea that would make his staff, particularly H.R. McMaster and Rex Tillerson, quite nervous.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Mueller, along with Robert Fox and Jeffrey Howard. More after the break. Do stay tuned.
Who can say where the world's headed? Well, with Monocle's transport-themed June issue in tow, you'll reach your destination enlivened and entertained, and with a good read on where things are heading. We stop off in Van, a Turkish city with a Persian pull that's luring fun-loving Iranians across the border. We meet Munich's fast-moving mobility players, get in gear with the finest bike retailers, and work up a sweat at Techno Gym's Toothsome HQ in Emilia Romagna in Italy. We're also on set in New York, in Hamburg for the annual Aircraft Interiors Expo, and in Albania for the Prime Minister's fictional final feast. All that, plus Oslo's fashion startups, the small-scale supermarkets with big ideas, and a peek at London's most ambitious new hospitality venture. So strap in. Monocle's high-octane transport issue is on newsstands now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Robert Fox and Jeffrey Howard. Now, in a probably inevitable consequence of an age in which pretty much anybody can broadcast pretty much any sentiment to as wide an audience as they can reach, an answering determination has developed in some quarters not to hear things or people that the beholder may find disagreeable. US Vice President Mike Pence was on the receiving end of such treatment at the weekend when dozens of graduates of Notre Dame University in Pence's native Indiana walked out of his commencement speech, and in related news, a leak of Facebook's internal guidelines for permitted content has illuminated the scale and difficulty of policing a planet-sized speaker's corner. Robert, first of all, to Pence, and you wouldn't, of course, want to live in a country in which you couldn't walk out on the vice president. And I'm reminded of the time I managed to lose my Secret Service minder in Baghdad because he took me to a terribly boring speech by Tariq Aziz, which, of course, he couldn't leave. But I could, so I did. He was most upset with me afterwards. Is this, however, effective protest?
I don't know. I was reading very carefully the Twitter trail, sorry, of the protesters, which were pretty reasonable, but given Pence's stance on things like gay rights and that... it was a few dozen, as you say. It was very orderly. It was very quiet. And I think, actually, it's not a question of no platforming him, which was it was dressed up as at one point by the regime. It is it was really a very reasoned protest by people who said this is the first time we've had a vice president who's a native of this place, who's done the commencement here at Notre Dame. And he said some pretty terrible things about our colleagues from the gay and the lesbian and transgender community. And it was done. It was strong. It was not strident, as far as I can make out. And that is the point. And he gave, actually, the speech. I don't want to be totally anti-Trump regime, but it was incredibly patronizing.
well, Jeffrey, the vice president was talking about, it's become a familiar conservative bugbear, I'm sure the hysterically overinflated idea that universities have becoming completely shrill, screeching, hostile environments for anybody with a point of view to the right of Abby Hoffman. But he was discussing what he called speech code safe zones, tone policing, administration-sanctioned political correctness. Is he entirely wrong? I mean, universities, especially in America, do tend towards the liberal in their outlook, and they are not always, not just in recent social media amplified times, but they're not always historically welcoming of conservative voices.
He's not entirely wrong, and I think there's a legitimate worry here that I wouldn't say free speech is under assault on campus. That would be overstated, but...
Well, indeed, no one was stopping Pence from talking.
Indeed, but reasoned debate, a willingness to seek out points of view with which you disagree, hear the best that can be said on their behalf, and then reckon intelligently with them. I do think that that is not under threat. Again, that would overstate it, but not as robust as we might want it to be. So I don't think he's entirely wrong. I think that there, though, is an important distinction between inviting a speaker to a campus for the purpose of bestowing an honor on that speaker, celebrating that speaker, and inviting a speaker to a campus for the purpose of engaging that speaker in reasoned debate, inviting the speaker to come into a kind of gauntlet of critical reflection that a university is
supposed to be. Because asking somebody to give the commencement speech is a great honor, isn't it?
It looks like the former. It looks like an honor. As far as I know, there weren't questions afterward. There wasn't an opportunity for students to raise their hands and mount passionate arguments and protest, hear what he had to say in response. And as a result of that, I think it's perfectly reasonable for a student to say, listen, at this university, we want to stand for a fundamental set of moral values, and the policies that this man has supported in the past suggest that he's at odds with the values that we cherish at this university. So while it would be appropriate to have him come speak in a forum where we could challenge him and argue with him, it's not appropriate to have him come speak in a manner that venerates him. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable point of view.
A quick thought on the Facebook dilemma, Robert. The leak of the documents about their guidelines about what they should put on their platform, what they shouldn't. If nothing else, it did illustrate the scale and the absolute impossibility of their job. They were talking about getting literally millions of complaints about various sorts of contents every day. Such decision makers as they have often only get 10 seconds to decide on an individual case. Is this Facebook's job, though, or should government step in to regulate what goes online?
Well, it is the great problem of electronic media platforms as to whether they're publishers or not. If they really are publishers, then they are liable in terms of the law. It is very, very difficult because the free fire zone that is out there for abuse, and this is what Facebook, in all fairness to them, is trying to address. It's a nightmare with Twitter. There's a wonderful piece, again, sorry, in the New York Times, but excellent piece, an interview with Ev Williams, who is, I think, still the biggest shareholder in Twitter, in which he's saying it is a complete nightmare. And he's particularly galled at the fact, is he said he cannot entirely discount the argument that Twitter was responsible for the election of Donald J.
I think it absolutely was. There is no way he wins the election without Twitter.
Of Donald J. Trump. And it's very interesting because Ev Williams has tried to start exactly, to say, a forum of very reasoned debate, of me talking about, you know, I read that book, I was rereading Camus or for something like that the other day. What do you think? Was he really good? Is cracked up? Which do you really think was the best? Argument and debate at that level, which is really like the coffee houses of 18th century Europe, which was the glory of the encyclopedia and so on. Sorry, dream on. We're not going to get it. And of course, they're trying to do it. The founder of Wikipedia, Jimmy Wales, is trying to get back reasonable journalism. Journalists are unreasonable, but they've got to go on being unreasonable and be journalists.
I think as well in the cafes of 19th century Vienna, people were talking in sentences longer than 140 characters. And actually, on a not unrelated story, we should move along finally to the German town of Trier, which is spending much of this year trying to figure out what to do about next year, which will be the 200th anniversary of the birth within its limits of Karl Marx. China, happy to help, is to donate an 18-foot-tall bronze statue of the economic philosopher. A wooden cutout has been enjoying a trial run. However, not all locals are delighted, especially those who can recall a time not so long ago when half of Germany was held prisoner by a tyranny consecrated to Marx's teachings. Jeffrey, why are Trier accepting this? Should they say, well, thanks, but no, not really? It's a weird one, isn't it?
It is an odd one. I mean, clearly, it's important to China's identity that it still be viewed as a communist country. That's despite the fact that it's decidedly not a communist country. It's a kind of capitalist autocracy. It embraces the very capitalist market that Marx regarded as the engine of exploitation. And I think partly because the legitimacy of the Chinese ruling class is coming under increasing strain, there is, again, this need to have a coherent, moralized narrative about what the country stands for. And perhaps small gestures like that are just tokens of this much broader effort upon the ruling class in China to emphasize this identity as a communist society. Look, for Trier, I mean, I think it's important to be upfront with our history. I deride the efforts to whitewash history by taking down all the plaques and all the statues and putting them away for no one to see. I think put up all the statues, have the statue of Cecil Rhodes with a plaque telling you just what an awful person he was, right? And similarly, we can say, gosh, here was a really influential political and economic philosopher whose ideas, some would say on the left, were misinterpreted. Some would say were fated to fail from the start, led to an awful lot of horror in human history. I think reckon with our history rather than ignore it. And insofar as China's letting us do that without having to pay for the statue ourselves, then the people of Trier might welcome it.
Robert, you're mayor of Trier for the next 15 seconds. Do you take the statue or not?
Of course you do. I know a wonderful statue of a Rhodes in the Netherlands called Kuhn. In Hoorn, where he came from in the early 17th century. Wonderful statue of the 19th century. They've got it there, and they have got precisely the kind of plaque that you have described, Geoffrey, that some people thought he was a great empire builder, but for us, in inverted commas, he was a pretty rotten bastard.
On that equivocal note, Robert Fox and Geoffrey Howard, thank you both for joining us at Midori House. That is all for today's show. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Christian Radev. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next at 1900. It's The Culture Show with Robert Bound. I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at 1800 tomorrow London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.